I think there are signs aplenty that the Kremlin is getting worried about the situation at home. But that doesn't necessarily mean that Russia is the most heavily policed country in the world. More on that later. Hello, I'm Mark Galliotti, and welcome to my view of Russia in Moscow Shadows. This podcast, of varying length, frequency and format, yet always reassuringly low production values, is supported by generous and perspicacious patrons like you, and also by the crisis exercise software company Conductor. I'm recording this episode on the morning of Sunday the 20th of August. 20th of August, that's the day in 1991, where I would argue the hardliners' coup against Gorbachev and against the whole notion of reform of the Soviet Union failed. The first day, after all, was one of confusion. It was one in which many people frankly just assumed that, of course, the coup would work out because, well, they had all the, apparently, the panoply of power of the state on their side. And the third day was in some ways the day when the coup actually collapsed. But as I said, I think the second day was arguably, in that respect, the pivotal one. It was the day that KGB chief Kruchkov, defense minister Yazov, and interior minister Pugo finally decided to attack the White House, the specifically Russian government headquarters, which had become the rallying point around which Boris Yeltsin, and president of the Russian Federation within the Soviet Union, had decided to make his stand and in front of which crowds were gathering to defend it. This was going to be Operation Grom, Thunder. For some reason, it always seems to be Operation Grom. Anyway, at this point, on this day, the commander of the KGB's Alpha Group, its specialized anti-terrorist commando force, General Viktor Karpukhin, and his counterpart at Vimpel, the other sort of main such operation, Colonel Biaskov, having checked out the situation, they tried to convince KGB General Gennady Agayev, who was Kruchkov's deputy, that the operation would just result in bloodshed and, frankly, excessive bloodshed and ought to be cancelled. And this was enough to help, galvanise opposition forces even within the military. We had General Lebed, who would go on to later on become a key political figure, also bringing about the end of the First Chechen War. Anyway, with the consent of his superior, who was overall paratrooper force commander General Pavel Grachov, actually went to the White House, secretly met with the people running the defense, and warned them that the attack was scheduled to begin at 2 o'clock the next morning, so they needed to make their preparations. And I think this is a crucial thing because it demonstrated how, even while notionally pretending to be loyal to the emergency committee which had seized power, you had senior figures, including exactly that, the commander of all the paratrooper forces, conniving with the other side. I think it's worth dwelling on that because, look, I'm not going to suggest that for the moment, at present, we have similar kind of conspiracies emerging within the Russian military and security apparatus. Because to be honest, until the day before, there hadn't been a conspiracy in the Soviet Union. It was just a sign, I think, of just how quickly these kind of things can cohere and how far they can cohere behind the scenes. You know, at the same time, Lebed, Grachov, Karpukhin, Peskov, they were all notionally obeying the orders of their properly constituted command structures, while at the same time actually trying to connive at the failure of the coup and for the White House defenders to be able to protect themselves. Something that's worth bearing in mind. As I say, not because I think for a moment there's any kind of real prospect of a coup in Russia. However, it does remind us that this is a regime which knows full well from its own experiences, from the things it has seen happen in its own country, just how fragile power can be, and how even when you believe you have the preponderance of force on your side, you may need to worry. And certainly there are all kinds of signs of worry on the part of the Kremlin at the moment. And let me just cycle through a few of them. The first one, which I'm not really going to talk about right now because I'm largely going to leave to the second half, is the fact that a special forces unit by the name of, guess what, Grom, Thunder, has been transferred, or is currently being transferred, rather, from the Interior Ministry to the Rosgvardia, the National Guard. And again, I think it's quite symbolic, as it's a movement of resources away from policing and towards public order and internal security. But as I said, I want to talk about that more in a more broad context in the second half of this podcast. Then we have the decision to sentence Alexei Navalny to another consecutive 19 years in prison, and more to the point, 19 years in a special regime prison colony, which will very much limit his opportunities for access with the outside world. And I think this is obviously the important thing. It's precisely about keeping him away from his own people and his capacity to communicate. Now, this is actually, I mean, there's still people who hold on to a rather moronic notion that somehow Navalny is a stooge of the FSB because what he says is somehow deemed convenient or it helps split the opposition or whatever. I think this is entirely ridiculous and, frankly, quite spiteful. More interesting, though, that there has been debate about whether or not he actually wrote his most recent and indeed other manifestos and statements, you know, people who've tried to use textual analysis and the like. Look, this does actually speak to the whole issue of how someone who was obviously in the prison system can from time to time send out streams of tweets or indeed fully formed and nicely written manifestos. I don't think it was ever the case that we should assume that Navalny produces everything himself, whether we're talking about the video investigations he used to front up or indeed these documents. Now, ironically, while he was actually on trial, he had a lot more contact with his lawyers. And I think it's generally the lawyers' visits that are the crucial points for him to actually be able to express his views. And yes, I'm sure that often it is the case that what he does is he sort of puts out a general line or maybe a series of bullet points or fragmentary documents or Twitter streams or whatever, and other people flesh them out for him. I mean, the claim is after all been made that in fact the most recent manifesto, like others, was written by Georgi Alburov based on textual analysis. Now, Alburov was the head of the Anti-Corruption Foundation's investigations department, and he played a pretty crucial role in all these kind of fascinating video exposés that were put together, particularly the one on Chaika and the former prosecutor general, and also that most infamous of all, the one "He is not Dimon to you" about Dmitry Medvedev's assets and the like. Alburov, not himself, I would suggest, a great presenter, but clearly a great investigator, but also a good writer. I don't think there's anything to be surprised about. I mean, do we all assume that every single great orator in history, you know, presidents and prime ministers, always wrote all their own stuff? Well, I think the answer's no. And I think it's a bit of a, if I call it a shame, I'm practicing English understatement here. I think it's actually quite disgraceful in some ways how people have fastened on the fact that, yes, probably Navalny does not actually write every single word that goes out under Navalny's imprimatur. We have absolutely no reason to feel that he is uncomfortable with what is being said in his name. He has had the opportunity, if he wanted to distance himself from that, he could. Indeed, he probably could have done so to earn some brownie points with the state. Instead, we just have to realise that this is a team in some ways trying to channel and support Navalny as he does his time behind razor wire. But nonetheless, as I said, the fact that the state decided to actually put him in behind bars for another 19 years, in other words, essentially just trying to lock him away for the foreseeable future, I think does say something about how worried he is about someone like him who can actually articulate a coherent and appealing anti-Kremlin message without seeming to be some kind of an anti-patriotic stooge of the West. Because after all, this takes part in the context of a whole series of other actions against opposition from both the liberal and the illiberal side of things. On the liberal side of things, we've seen, for example, the final closure of the Sakharov Center. I mean, back in 2016, I had the honour of speaking there, and it's really quite sad to think that, you know, what had remained a beacon of a kind of peaceable and non-partisan liberalism that didn't get involved in all the internecine squabbles of so much of the anti-Kremlin movement, but that has gone. What else? Well, we've had Georgi Melkonyants, who's the co-chair of Golos, which means voice or vote, and was basically the key institution monitoring the elections and indeed the frauds thereof. Well, you know, he's now been detained with the investigatory committee claiming that he was working with undesirable groups. Again, I think it's clear that, Golos is to basically face the same kind of dissolution as all the other movements. Just in time, incidentally, for, yes, first the local elections, which more in a moment, and then next year's presidential poll. But it's not just on the liberal side. We've also had the arrest of Igor Girkin, Strelkov, who for so long had remained this sort of paradoxically outspoken and yet unsuppressed figure in the sort of more turbo-patriot side of things. His, frankly, pretty trenchant analyses of what was going wrong with the quote-unquote special military operation had clearly bugged the Kremlin for a long time. But I think they've decided, no, enough is enough after the mutiny. We now appreciate that we also face a challenge from the right, from the nationalist dimension, and we should do something about it. And Strelkov Girkin's arrest was, I think, a major symbolic act. It is one, it is worth noting, that has created considerable disquiet and indeed anger amongst the more sort of turbo-patriot side of things, which includes people within the security apparatus. I mean, for a long time, my view has been that Girkin was allowed to continue doing his thing, in part as a pressure valve, but also in part because the Kremlin did not necessarily want to alienate the constituency within the security apparatus on which it depended. It's finally decided, well, it needed to act. And according to his wife, Miroslava Reginskaya, he's actually already quite seriously ill while sitting in Lefortovo, the political prison. And what I thought was a particularly interesting little sort of note was that Leonid Razvozhayev, who is a leftist oppositionist who was abducted from Ukraine in 2012, you know, in the pre-Euromaidan days, and then was put on trial in Moscow, and alongside sort of rather more firebrand leftist Sergei Udaltsov, was sentenced to prison in 2014, and I think he was released in 2017. But, you know, even Razvozhayev is speaking up on behalf of Strelkov, not necessarily saying that all his views are lovely, but nonetheless, you know, again, presenting this point of view that this is a man who, in his own way, is a man of honour, and he is being treated dishonourably. So it's quite interesting the way that we can still sometimes see unexpected horizontal connections between anti-government figures who may actually share very little politically other than a conviction that this regime must go. So, you know, this could still turn around to seriously bite the Kremlin. We'll have to wait and see. But it's only part of a general continuing sort of tightening of the screws. We've had more bans and expulsions, particularly journalists, for example, including Eva Hartog, who had been editor-in-chief of the Moscow Times to 2019. And generally, I can't help but get the feeling that the Kremlin has decided that it's not going to bother caring anymore. It's not going to bother caring what people might think. It doesn't necessarily need to present even the thinnest and flimsiest excuses for the things it's going to do. It just will embrace the fact that it's regarded, certainly internationally, as, you know, the baddie, or at least in the West, and lean into that and, as it were, enjoy the options that that provides it. But, of course, the real challenge is actually going to be domestic. And here I want to dig into, quite an interesting situation in, of all places, Khakassia, the southern Siberian region, known for its natural beauty, and also its prowess at bandy, a sporting game which to me seems almost entirely indistinguishable from ice hockey, but then again I haven't really cared enough to look into it in any more detail. Population just over 500,000, of whom the ethnic Hakkas only represent just under 13%, with Russians 82%. Again, one of the signs why we shouldn't assume that constituent or national republics necessarily are any more actually dominated by those nations. Anyway, in this region, well, this is the only region where there's a real chance of a serious political struggle for the governorship in September's elections. Back in 2018, I'm trying to think. Yes, it was 2018. There was something of a sort of a protest wave that took place in the gubernatorial elections, largely because the government had just raised the retirement age. And we had the government candidates losing in four of these huge constituencies. Primorye, maritime region, Khabarovsk on the Chinese border, Vladimir in European Russia, and Khakassia. Now, the thing is that pretty much in every case, the state struck back. I mean, in Primorye, the Central Election Committee basically annulled the results of voting in the first round, and then duly the United Russia candidate was able to win in the rerun. In Vladimir, there the Liberal Democrat, quote-unquote, LDPR being much more of a sort of illiberal, undemocratic party, won, but then resigned in 2021 to go and take up a seat in the State Duma. Reportedly, he was made an offer he couldn't refuse. In Khabarovsk, most dramatically, the LDPR governor, Sergei Furgal, was arrested in 2020 on suspicion of organising contract killings back in the 1990s. I mean, you know, how many of us can say that they didn't do that kind of thing in the 1990s? And then he was then duly sentenced to 22 years in prison as a result. But in Khakassia, we still have the communist candidate, 35-year-old Valentin Konovalov, who's made it through, and he's standing against United Russia's Sergei Sokol. Now, obviously, look, both of these are systemic candidates. We shouldn't present Konovalov as some kind of beacon of radicalism or whatever. But nonetheless, what's striking is the degree to which Konovalov has support from a wide range of other parties and groups. And most interestingly, I mean, he is in post precisely because, firstly, he is actually very popular, I think, popular at least, with local elites and the public. And Kremlin has kept trying to interfere with him, undermine him. And in particular, I think we can put this down to Kirienko, the first deputy head of the presidential administration, for whom, frankly, his election was actually something of a personal defeat, given that he had been trying to manage the previous round of gubernatorial elections. And so, you know, we see this continued sniping. I mean, according to Yuri Afonin, who's a deputy chairman of the Communist Party overall Central Committee, that, you know, that basically they've done analysis of the local broadcasting company, the TV and radio one, Khakassia. It prepared 43 negative stories out of 63 about Konovalov in 6 months, whereas there were 61 stories about our opponent from United Russia, all of them of a positive content. Now, one can perhaps quibble with whether or not Afonin is going to be an objective observer in this case, but nonetheless, you know, others have attested to the fact that it's clear that the media has been trying to big up Sokol and bring down the communist Konovalov. But guess what? The more that the state tips its hand and makes it clear that it wants Konovalov gone, interestingly enough, the more it has actually strengthened Konovalov's standing. I mean, he's smart enough to avoid any direct criticism of Putin, so he doesn't fall foul of that taboo. And because, let's face it, there are so few Communist Party victories, and yet the Kremlin still wants to keep the communists on side, they have actually dug in their heels on this particular one. And it's also worth noting that Konovalov has another indirect advantage from the particular cutthroat and cannibalistic nature of Kremlin politics. Enemies of Kirienko want to see Kyrenko suffer. And so to a degree, they may well also have been trying to provide some kind of indirect support for Konovalov. And according to some rumours, that may well include Volodin, the chair of the State Duma. Now, Sokol is not a local to Khakhassia. He's just a United Russia hack who's been brought in. And he tried to boost his chances with a little tour of the quote-unquote special military operation, in which he served a few months notionally in the Cascade Battalion. Now, Cascade, surprisingly enough, is a supposedly elite unit, but in fact it's quite the opposite. It clearly has been designated the safe place for members of the elite and their kids to go and play soldier. For example, 56 members of the State Duma and various regional assemblies have been identified serving a tour. I think three of them have died. What a shame. But here's the irony. Before he went to go and play soldier, Sokol was actually edging ahead. According to the BBC Russian service, some hidden polls, in other words, unreleased ones, by Vtsiom, which is the government polling agency, showed Sokol with 38% approval to Konovalov's 32%. But then they made this big splash about Sokol having served at the front and such like. And lo and behold, by the end of July, Konovalov is back on top with 42% to Sokol's 34%. Now look, the Kremlin will probably still get Sokol in. They'll find some way, whether it's just simply vote rigging or some way of disqualifying Konovalov or whatever. They will probably get their way in September. But I do think this says something about public opinion and the war. And in that context, a sociologist, Oleg Zhuravlyov, of the Public Sociology Lab, which carries out surveys, but particularly it does interviews and focus group meetings, which is important, I think, but they're still running those within Russia. And they've been reporting that their findings have been very different from the kind of, you know, large number surveys from Levada and other polling organizations that we have seen reported so far, which tend to sort of seem to show, at least on the face of it, majority support for the war. And what they're actually saying is that once you get beyond the kind of the tick box level of surveying opinion and start actually digging in through interviews, what you get is actually a rather different perspective. First of all, those who support the war, or say that they support the war at first blush, when you dig into it, say, well, it's not actually that they necessarily believe in it. It's not that they necessarily believe in its goals or the way it's being conducted. But they just simply say, and this is the quote that was used, we are apolitical people. We don't understand anything in politics, just as we don't understand anything in our government. We do not like this war, but presumably people in power know something special about world politics that we don't know. And we hope that they had reason to start this war. So I think that's really interesting. I mean, generally speaking, it actually, you know, according to the Public Sociology Laboratory's findings, majority of Russians actually reject the imperialist perspective being pushed out by the Kremlin. They accept the notion of Ukrainian statehood, in that they accept that Ukraine has a right to exist, but perhaps they feel that, you know, or at least they hope, that the powers that be had reasons for doing what they're doing. And why I think that's important is because it really does highlight the extent to which this is a political and indeed moral battle still to be fought, that is still open. I mean, you know, my view is still that in fact we're probably talking about a kind of a quarter of the people being supportive of the war effort in one form or another. I mean, genuinely supportive. A quarter being genuinely opposed, and a half the population that doesn't really know, and in a way doesn't know how it would know, and doesn't really want to know. That is really the moral and political battleground. How do these people get reached? How are these people allowed, or maybe even forced, to get an opinion? And maybe it's going to be precisely when, you know, more and more boys come home in zinc boxes. Maybe it's going to be when there's another mobilization wave, or there's going to be some other reversal on the battlefield, Or maybe because there's going to be a success, and perhaps at some point in a year's time, a reluctant Ukraine that feels it can't fight anymore, and that the Trump is about to head into the White House and so forth, is forced to make a deal. I mean, look, I have no idea. I'm just presenting you the fan of possibilities or whatever. You know, maybe that will help shape their opinion. But as I said, the key thing at the moment to hold on to is the degree to which most Russians are not supporters of this war. And this, I think, very valuable work from the Public Sociology Laboratory, firstly, is just a heartening reminder that people in Russia can still do serious opinion-related and therefore implicitly political work, despite all the oppressions. And secondly, gives us a reason as to why the Kremlin is worried. Why the Kremlin realizes that, in fact, it needs to silence opposing voices, particularly ones, whether we're talking about Strelkov or Navalny, who could indeed be catalytic in bringing around kind of alliances against the Kremlin. Why it wants to stop people from, like Golos, looking deeply into actually how it rigs its elections. Why, even just one figure, 35-year-old communist governor in Khakassia of all places, why that actually becomes a national issue. Because of the degree it shows that, in fact, even with all the administrative resource at the disposal of the Kremlin's candidates, still sometimes they fail, and still sometimes the Kremlin feels it has to accept the failure of its machine. Put all that together, and one can understand why today's Kremlin, which in many ways, frankly, is not the descendant of Boris Yeltsin's defenders, but actually, I think, owes so much of its attitudes and its fears to the Vazmyorka, the Council of Eight, the people in this emergency commission who thought that Gorbachev had gone too far and was going to bring about the dissolution of their entire system, and that all they could do was essentially try to turn the clock back through the use of force and fear. Well, quite frankly, provides much more of a sense of the credo of today's Kremlin. So no wonder they may not be sleeping that calmly. Of course, to a large extent, they will depend on the security apparatus. And although we tend to focus on the military and the FSB and the Rosgvardia, that also includes the ordinary police. So, after a break, let me talk about them. Just the usual mid-episode reminder that you're listening to the In Moscow Shadows podcast. Its corporate partner and sponsor is Conductor, which provides software for crisis exercises in hybrid warfare, counter-terrorism, civil affairs and the like. But you can also support the podcast yourself by going to patreon.com/inmoscowshadows. And remember that patrons get a variety of additional perks depending on their tier, as well as knowing that they're supporting this peerless source on all things Russian. And you can also follow me on Twitter at Mark Galliotti, or on Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. Now, back to the episode. I must say that I do think that study of the police, first the Soviet and then the Russian one, has been unfairly neglected. Not so much in their role as some sort of adjunct to the overall repressive security apparatus, but in some ways because police forces are one of those crucial areas in which the state and society, have to and do connect all the time. And it actually has a real impact on how society thinks about the state. Is it on my side? Is it rapacious? Is it inefficient? Is it uncaring? But also how the state can actually begin to influence society. So, I think, again, just a little plea for more studies of the police force, which I must admit, again, has been a subject of unhealthy fascination for me. And overall, if I had to say what we're seeing of late is the degree to which actually policing is, in Russia, in a certain, actually, I think, not quite say crisis situation, but certainly a tough place. And to a considerable extent, this is because it has been neglected or indeed abused by the Kremlin. We know that, frankly, there was considerable dissatisfaction within the force at their use as stormtroopers of repression, certainly during the Bolotnaya protests and such like. And in fact, that was one of the reasons for the creation of Rosgvardia out of the Interior Ministry's public order assets. It was precisely that Interior Minister Kolokoltsev was reporting to the Kremlin the degree to which he was getting disquietant messages from various police commands, saying that actually being used in this role is interfering with our opportunities to build connections with society. And it's worth noting, lest this sound too warm and fuzzy, that in fact connections to society are absolutely essential for police to do their job. Not just in terms of them being able to sort of safely go on patrol, but also in the majority, for example, of organised crime busts that are made in the West are done on the basis of people being willing to come forward as informants and tell the police something that's going on. If you fear the police, you don't talk to them. This is one of the reasons why actually smart police forces do want to cultivate close connections with society. And in fact, that was something that Kolokoltsev was trying to do. But when he expressed these various concerns, his hope was therefore that the Kremlin would stop using the police in this role, which is kind of what happened, because it simply took all the heavy boys, the interior troops, the Amon riot police, the Sobor special weapons response teams, and just simply moved them to a brand new agency under Viktor Zolotov, a man who had no such qualms about going and cracking skulls. So very much they have been neglected of late over public order. The irony is, though, in a way, this can also provide them with an opportunity, a chance to continue a process that had been taking place until the recent crisis, which is actually to cleanse itself. There were real constituencies within the NVD, within the Interior Ministry, who had wanted to address questions of unprofessionalism and particularly of corruption. Again, realizing that this was actually a real impediment to their actually being develop a more positive and productive role with society. And the interesting thing is, it's exactly the neglect, sometimes frankly malign neglect, that we're getting from the Kremlin, which is in some ways, in a paradoxically manner, and I'll come on to in more detail to explain this, actually helping the Interior Ministry be less political and less corrupt. Now, of course, that said, the Kremlin can still use the police whenever and however it wants. But on the other hand, we also have to recognise the degree to which the police force is not quite this omnipotent force that some would suggest. And particularly at the moment, we're once again getting the claims that Russia is one of the most heavily policed country in the world. Well, again, this has been a particular hobby horse of mine. I will also want to address that and explain why the statistics are not actually necessarily telling us what we may think. But this was very much triggered by the news that Grom, the last of the Interior Ministry's specialist sort of commando units, is likely to be transferred to the Rosgvardia. Now, why this matters is this, and again, my apologies for going into a certain amount of security force wonkery here. Grom had been part of the Federal Anti-Drug Service, and, you know, its role was therefore to spearhead attacks on, you know, drugs busts and refinery sites and the like. And it is a pretty good specialist force. When the Interior Ministry lost all its public order assets, you know, wrenched from it to create the new National Guard, in some ways, as a rather backhanded compensation, they got the Federal Anti-Drug Service, which was rolled back into the Interior Ministry. And part of that was Grom. Now, with the transfer of Sobor, these sort of SWAT teams, to Rosgvardia, that actually created a massive operational headache for the police. Because up to that point, if they were going, I mean, let's remember, the Russian police are, it's an armed police force. But nonetheless, you know, if you found yourself in a situation where you were going to need specialist backup, or if all of a sudden you had officers who found themselves in a sticky situation, in the old days, because they were all part of the police, it was very easy and quick to whistle up some Sobor support. Now, in those circumstances, you had to, usually it had to go up your chain of command, your commanders would have to talk to their oppos in the National Guard and arrange for the release of some Sobor assets, for which, frankly, the Interior Ministry would have to pay. There was a kind of cross-charging figure. So it all made it much more complex, much more sort of, well, expensive, frankly, for the Interior Ministry. Remember, all bureaucracies worry about money. But more to the point, also slower. So again, you know, police in a crisis could not necessarily count on Solbara being there quickly to bail them out. So, with Grom now part of the Interior Ministry, clearly Kolokoltsev had visions that Grom could actually fill this gap. And we increasingly saw Grom expanding in size, acquiring more and more regional units, because after all, you need these guys to be close by if there's going to be a crisis, and generally taking over the roles of the Sobor, so the police were not quite so dependent on the Rosgvardia. Viktor Zolotov over at Rosgvardia, though, is an empire builder. I mean, frankly, how many Russian officials are not? And he clearly resented this. He resented the fact that the Interior Ministry had its own Sobor likes and had been lobbying for some time to actually have Grom brought under his control, saying that, well, look, it makes sense. You know, we're the guys who need to have all this kind of specialist door kicking in kind of resource at our disposal. After the mutiny, suddenly it seems that Putin is much more concerned about domestic security. You remember, this is the point where he suggested that the Rosgvardia might well get tanks and artillery for its interior troops, because after all, you know, nothing helps when dealing with a crowd of angry mothers than having tanks and artillery. But also, Grom is now being transferred to the Rosgvardia. There is a last-ditch struggle currently being sort of mounted to try and prevent that, but I think it seems highly unlikely that it won't happen. So what this shows us is precisely that the continuing and, in fact, deepening tilt away from the needs of the police and towards the needs of the state through public order forces. And I think we will likely see that continue. We're already beginning to see that although, for example, the policeman budget seems to be increasing, a certain amount of that, frankly, is actually just indirect spending, which is really going to the Rosgvardia. And this is, as I say, very much a sign of neglect of policing. And it's worth noting that the crime rates, although we have to accept that there are going to be some limitations with using the official Russian crime rates, but nonetheless, you know, they are showing increases in crime. They are showing that, in fact, especially areas bordering on to the war zone are suffering, you know, particular increases in armed crime. And I'm going to talk about this in more detail in a future podcast. So that's happening, but at the same time, as I said, perversely, this offers some kind of an opportunity. Not being in the central view of the eye of Sauron, sorry, I meant the eye of the Kremlin, actually means that you have a little bit more freedom of manoeuvre. Or maybe just simply you find yourself losing opportunities which are in themselves corrupting. And the particular example I have in mind is that there's now been a decision made that the police are no longer going to have the right to fine business people who basically breach a whole variety of essentially administrative ordinances. And this follows on from the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum, and it's very much been something that business ombudsman Boris Titov has been lobbying for. Now, this is good for the Prosecutor General's office, because they will now actually have a key role in terms of prosecuting people who break these ordinances. It's good for business, because let's be perfectly honest, this was a recipe for extortion. You know, police officers could go into businesses, claim to have detected various, you know, trivial infractions, and essentially extort money to overlook them. And in the process, may be good for the Interior Ministry in terms of fighting corruption. Precisely because, actually, the more you focus the efforts of the police on things that the police ought to be doing, firstly, you actually stop wasting their time. I mean, remember, back in the Soviet times, I mean, the militia even had to kind of constantly monitor the use of photocopiers. You know, you can imagine actually how much time gets wasted on responsibilities like that. I mean, obviously, because the state feared that photocopiers would be used to spread samizdat anti-government information. And indeed, they were right, but that's a whole other story. So they waste less time, but they also have less of those kind of tempting opportunities which do have a tendency to generate corruption at a time when, frankly, a policeman's lot in Russia is decidedly not a happy one. We've had Konovalov actually admitting that in July alone, 5,000 people quit the Interior Ministry and Internal Affairs bodies, and he said, "The shortage of personnel is very large. I would say that it's already critical. It's a difficult situation." It's a massive understatement, really, especially because it's clear that we're not just talking about beat police officers, but also investigators. And so the current situation is actually that, on paper, the Interior Ministry is set to expand. This year it's meant to be increasing from 894,000 to 922,000 employees. Next year it's meant to go up to 934,000, so in other words, an extra 12,000 people. And in 2025, crawling up to 938,000. Now, it's worth noting that back in the day, before it lost all its its security elements to the National Guard, the establishment strength of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, if you go back to, say, 2010, was a massive 1.4 million staff. And so it's easy to understand why people still, despite Carlo Coltsev's grumbles about the fact that they don't have enough people, nonetheless there is this assumption that Russia is this incredibly heavily policed country. And so most recently we had from Arbat Media claiming that actually in per capita terms Russia is the world leader in terms of police officers, and that there are 643 employees of the MVD for every 100,000 Russians, and they say that their comparisons are: in China it's 120, in India 128, and in the United States 256. Now, is it really possible that Russia is five times as densely policed as that free and easy hippie state of the People's Republic of China? Well, the answer is clearly no. And in part, this is precisely because of them actually being quite substantially under strength. And in some ways, that's really not surprising. Look, the average salary of a police officer is currently 44,000 rubles. That compares with an average salary overall, this is per month, obviously, of 72,000 rubles. So in other words, it's maybe, about 60% of the average salary. Let's compare that with a British police constable. Now, obviously, their salary depends on their actual sort of level of police constableness, but basically speaking, the salary ranges from £28,000 to £35,000 per year. The average salary in the UK is £28,000. So, in other words, the lower level of a British police constable is the national average, and then increases above it. And that's pretty much the normal. Look, police officers, especially armed police officers, you are necessarily expecting them to go into sometimes dangerous situations, often with deeply unsocial hours, finding themselves coping with what is often, frankly, the opprobrium of society. Of course, you actually have to pay them enough for it to be worth their while. And if you don't, firstly, you may well lose out on some of the better recruits. So obviously, a lot of people are going to be motivated just by the importance of the job and the feeling of doing something for society, but not everyone is. And at the same time, frankly, you are going to sort of lose out. The comparison is, after all, look, if you are a contract soldier or a mercenary in Ukraine, instead of the 44,000 rubles that a cop is being paid, you're going to be paid 204,000 rubles. Given that the police was often one of the career tracks that former soldiers would often move into, now, yes, obviously the risks are much greater in Ukraine, but if you're being paid almost five times as much to go and take that risk, maybe that's quite tempting. So this helps us explain why actually we need to sort of dig into some of this assumption about why Russia is not necessarily at the top table of police densities. To a large extent, these assessments are still based on United Nations Office of Drugs and Crime data, which goes back, frankly, to about 2010.
And it's worth noting, first of all, that their data excludes countries like Belarus, Azerbaijan, North Korea and Uzbekistan, which I think it's fair to say would probably skew the table in a different direction. But anyway, let's go back to those 2010 figures, because you know they're the ones we have most detail for, and there's no evidence to suggest that the overall picture has changed beyond the shrinkage of the MVD since then. So back in 2010, it had 1.4 million staff, as I said, including the Amon and the interior troops and the like, which were generally left. Arguably, though, actually Russia did not feel like an over-policed country, but actually an under-policed one. The 2010 establishment strength, you know, suggested that there was one police officer for every 101 citizens, compared with the UK's one for 254. But that was deceptive. The thing is, that 1.4 million figure included not just the interior troops, not just an unknown number of unfilled positions, and the higher estimate was about 40,000 empty slots, but more to the point, a much larger proportion of office workers compared with active police officers, you know, in other words, the sort of people who carry a badge and can make an arrest. The Russians have a tendency to use uniformed personnel for the kind of jobs which in the West would be handled by a civilian. Now, again, if we want to draw the comparison with Britain, just over half of the total strength in 2010 of 240,000 were actually police officers. Although it's hard to come up with precise figures, the Russian figure is probably closer to 40 to 45% actual police officers. The rest are basically paper pushers, but the point is they were uniformed paper pushers, so they get counted. So actually, you know, this immediately brings the real police officer to civilian ratios much closer. You know, basically it's one for every 267 citizens for Russia, one for 429 in the UK, or one for 380 in the United States. So yes, Russia is higher, but in fact it's rather different. Now, the MVD now has a strength of less than, you know, substantially less than a million. But nonetheless, again, a lot of these people are still not real cops. If we look at the Moscow GUMVD, the main directorate of the Ministry of Internal Affairs, in other words, the Moscow Police Department, which is, you know, rather more extensive and closer to establishment strength than most. I think the last figure I saw was about 94%, 95% staffed. If you compare that to London's Metropolitan Police, that had, at the end of 2011, I know I'm using dated figures, but I can't be bothered to dig out newer ones, and again, there's no sense that the balance has shifted particularly. The Met had 48,661 staff, of whom 65%, just over about 31,500, were actually sworn police officers. Then there were another just under 4,000, or 7.7%, police community support officers who were uniformed but civilian officers. So they, you know, they were used for sort of patrol and neighbourhood support roles, and the rest were civilian staff. Now, if we're generous and lump the community support officers in with the regular police, that basically means that the Met is, broadly speaking, three quarters cop, one quarter civilian. And that means it's roughly 430 officers for 100,000 population. Okay. In comparison, Moscow has an establishment strength of about 80,000. And as I said, it was about 95% strength, so we'll say 76,000 in reality. Now, even accepting that it's actually rather more efficient than most Russian police commands, it's roughly speaking got a 65% cop to civilian ratio. But the point is, everyone counts as a cop in this data. But but I'm talking about civilian jobs. That suggests that basically there's about 49,000 police, real police, responsible for a city with a notional population of 11.5 million at the time, though in practice it was probably rather larger. And that means that Moscow, which is the most heavily policed city in Russia other than Grozny, has 426 officers per 100,000 population. Now, I've thrown lots of numbers at you, so let me just give you a comparison. Remember, that's 426 cops for 100,000 population, compared with London's 430 for 100,000 population. So, actually, pretty damn close to London's. And, you know, if we look at the official tables, that's about the same sort of level as Algeria and below that of Kazakhstan. Again, I think it's important to stress that these are rough figures. But honestly, they feel right, because this is the thing. If one looks beyond Moscow and St. Petersburg, which are clearly given priority, and obviously Grozny for its own reasons, generally speaking, Russia's irony has, after all, often been that for its size, its heterogeneity, and the challenges, Russia has actually been historically under-policed. Not least because the regular police have taken second place to the powerful political police, whether it's the Okhrana and the Gendarmerie in Tsarism, the Cheka, NKVD and KGB in Soviet times, and now the FSB, who annex police resources to their own ends. And the point is, it's when police feel inadequate to the task, when they precisely feel under-resourced, when they feel isolated within society, that they are more likely to become hostile, predatory, corrupt, or just simply not even try and do their job. I mean, I remember going back to the 1990s, which was a very bad time for the Russian police. You know, at that point, in some cases, you would see proper policing going on. In others, I remember going to a police station which basically felt like a kind of a sandbagged outpost in the middle of Baghdad in the bad days. And once going on a ride-along with a police patrol, in which they literally just basically piled into their little Wazik jeep with all the usual ironmongery of Kalashnikov assault rifles and AKSU carbine and the like, got in, put on the blue lights, roared at speed along their designated patrol route. No attempt to sort of do it slow enough in order to see what's going on or allow people to flag you down or whatever. I mean, you basically would have to lie in front of them on the road if you'd hoped to basically get their attention, and even then they probably would have just simply driven over you. Anyway, roared through this route back to the police station. Whew, that's a relief. Patrol done. Again, you tick the box on the form to say that you've done it, and you stay back in your fortified little enclave. I mean, these were really bad times for policing, and again, it was because the police felt, firstly, thoroughly despised by the society as a whole. Secondly, that they felt that they were tremendously undercompensated. No wonder corruption increased, just as petty corruption amongst the police force is increasing now, because again, they feel under more economic pressure. And at the same time, they just simply felt unequal to the task. They knew that they were outgunned by the gangsters and such like. And so they retreated into their lagers. So in this context, I mean, actually, this is, you know, overall, Putin era has been good for the police in terms of expansion, in terms of equipment, and in terms of their connections to society. That is coming under pressure. You still have the sort of professionals still trying to actually do their job. Though, you know, as I said, resources to do policing rather than public order work are increasingly hard to come by. And generally, a police apparatus and police command structure which doesn't want to get involved in politics is finding politics thrust upon it. Now, look, I'm not trying to argue the MVD's case. Though, as Khodorkovtsev has proven such a bad politician, arguably someone has to do it. But nonetheless, I think this is, first of all, obviously a warning that with Russia, one should rarely take easy assumptions for granted. And these sort of nice statistics which seem to show what a police state it is, you know, are worth interrogating. But also, the very time when the Russian state is actually beginning to become clearly more worried about its control of its population and its country. Its very focus on the crude forms of social control, Rosgvardia and the FSB and the Investigatory Committee and so forth, putting people in prison because they express the wrong views, trying to intimidate others into keeping quiet and such like, is neglecting what is one of the kind of key intersections, shall we say, between state and society, which is the police force. We don't know quite how the police would go. During that August coup in 1991, the first day of the coup saw record levels of police calling in sick. They didn't know how things were going. They didn't know basically who would win. they didn't want to basically go out and crack the skulls of their neighbours for a coup that they didn't necessarily support and had no idea about, but nor were they quite at this stage willing to openly side with society against the state. So they thought they'd sit it out and wait and see. By day two, increasingly we found police beginning to side with protesters in Moscow, but not just in Moscow. Yeah, again, we focus on Boris Yeltsin standing on an armoured vehicle in front of the White House. We shouldn't forget the degree to which actually this was also being played out in a whole variety of other cities all across the Soviet Union. But anyway, yes, we began to see police either actively siding with the protesters or doing their jobs but refusing or avoiding to being used to suppress anti-coup plotters. And these are men with guns. These are part of the overall security structure. The coup plotters of 1991 essentially took them for granted. Interior Minister Boris Pugo, after all, was not one of them. He was a party hack and indeed former KGB officer. And he had no real connection with society. Kolokoltsev has been trying to kind of hold the line. He is, after all, a career cop. First career cop, really, to be able to try and grip the MBD for a long time. And has been trying to keep that balance. He expresses various nationalist populist notes when he needs to, but most of the time he's just busy doing his job. Now, in political terms, that means he's screwed. She has very, very little political traction, precisely because he's essentially a technocrat in uniform rather than a Putin loyalist. So the police have suffered, there's no question. But the police know that full well. And the interesting thing is, when the chips are down, if and when there is some real crisis, whose side are they going to be on? Habit and momentum means you obey the Kremlin. Quite possibly, though, personal interest, especially with talk that in fact police ought to be being summoned to go and serve in Ukraine. But anyway, personal interest and the fact that cops are on the whole embedded within ordinary society. Their kids go to the same schools as everyone else. They live in the same housing blocks as everyone else. You know, that may well mean that they're actually disinclined to do so. We'll just have to see. I honestly don't know which way they would jump if and when there's some kind of a crisis. But two final points are worth making. First of all, however much you slice and dice the statistics, we're still talking about over 500,000 men and women who are armed, and not just armed in terms of their service sidearms, but assault rifles, sniper rifles, and the works, and who are disproportionately based in places with particular government or economic importance. And secondly, I do think it is interesting about what it shows about the myopia of an essentially ex-KGB political leadership, that they just ultimately don't think the cops count. I suspect they're wrong. Well, that's the end of another episode of the In Moscow Shadow podcast. Just as a reminder, beyond this, you can follow my blog, also called In Moscow Shadows. Follow me on Twitter, at Mark Galliotti, or Facebook, Mark Galliotti on Russia. This podcast is made possible by generous and enlightened patrons, and you too can be one. Just go along to my Patreon page, that's patreon.com/inmoscowshadows, and decide which tier you want to join, getting access to exclusive materials and other perks. However, whether or not you contribute, thank you very much indeed for listening. Until next time, keep well.